we've just had that nice air of expectancy with everyone quietening down, so it seemed like a good signal for me to start. So good evening, everyone. Very pleased that you are here. Welcome to this first Dean's Lecture of this year's series, the seventh year of the Dean's Lecture series. And tonight's lecture, Professor Richard Nossens, he's actually setting a new trend. This is actually his second Dean's Lecture. So I'm delighted, Richard, that you're back in Melbourne with us. Once our registrations got over 250, we had to move out of our Queensbury Street building to here, and I'm pleased that you've all found us, and I'm also thankful for your support. And I'm particularly pleased that our Chancellor has joined us, Elizabeth Alexander and Sir Andrew Grimwade, and more about Sir Andrew in a moment. I'd also like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of the land that we hold this lecture, and I pay respect to the elders both past and present of the Kulin Nation and extend that respect to other Indigenous Australians present. So, word on the format. After the conclusion of Richard's presentations, Professor John Hattie will make a vote of thanks, then you'll be invited to join us out in the foyer at the back. We'll provide you with some light refreshments. So, Richard Noss is here at the University of Melbourne as part of the Magunya Distinguished Visiting Fellowship Program. This fellowship program was made possible through the Russell Grimwade bequest. The fellowship program was established in 1993. It was actually the suggestion of Sir Andrew Grimwade that we establish this program, and fellowships are awarded to scholars of international distinction and preeminence. This looks like I have to move across here. And so since the program began in 1993, there's been 93 scholars, and it continues to flourish. Scholars contribute to the research culture of the university in the interests of the wider community. An important duty of each fellow is, of course, the public lecture, and hence this celebration tonight. So now it gives me great pleasure to tell you a little bit more about our speaker, our Magunya fellow, Professor Richard Noss. He is preeminent internationally with regard to the use of information technologies in education. He's here for 4 weeks with his partner, Celia Hoyles, who is also a professor in mathematics education. Richard is a professor in mathematics education at the Institute of Education at the University of London. He holds a master's degree in pure mathematics, but a PhD in mathematical education. These are from King's College London. He has taught originally at all levels of the education system, so he knows teaching. He then became a lecturer at the Institute in 1986, and 10 years later he was a professor. His research has always involved technology and mathematics, but some 6 years ago he changed the focus, and the focus was to technology and learning more broadly. And he founded the London Knowledge Lab, an interdisciplinary facility at the university that is, in its own strapline words, quote, exploring the future of learning with digital technologies. This was a visionary move that required forging new formal and informal links with computer scientists from Birkbeck College London, and the Knowledge Lab was just what was needed at the time. With Richard as director, the lab's become an internationally recognised centre which attracts millions of pounds, millions of euros from external funding from the UK and overseas, and from the centre there's been wide publishing in the field of learning technologies. Richard is on record as believing that the best way to research the application of learning technologies is to build them. And this ethos has guided the work of his lab since its launch. Also, in 2008, Richard became director of UK's Technology Enhanced Learning Research Programme. It's funded jointly by the Economic and Social Science Research Council and the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council. It involves some 200 researchers across more than 30 universities and engages policymakers, educators, computer scientists, and industrial partners in the design, implementation, and evaluation of learning technologies. This program promises to have results that will shape the way, I think, that technology is designed and used for learning in the future. Richard's co-directed more than 20 research projects. In the last 10 years, he's written 6 books, published 200 articles. He's renowned in both mathematics and technological field and is internationally known and respected in the area of learning technologies. His track record, I think, reads a bit like a cricket scoreboard. But having said that, this is a sport he closely follows, and he has, on this trip, been to the long room at the MCG. So he's really experienced the pleasures of Melbourne. Clearly, he's an active researcher. He's a teacher. He's a scholar. I understand he's also an amateur blues pianist, but I don't think we get that tonight. So I think you'll find he's the most outstanding and engaging speaker. So I'm going to, Richard, hand over to you. I'm personally delighted to invite you to present tonight's lecture, which is entitled Learning the Unlearnable, Teaching the Unteachable.
Thank you, Phil. Well, you're probably just about ready to go home now, I think. Can I start by thanking Field formally, thanking Sir Andrew Grimwade, without whose vision I wouldn't be here, or at least I wouldn't have had my airfare paid, so a special thank you to you. And to Professor David Clark, who managed to organise his diary so that he's flying to Vietnam at this very moment, but without him I wouldn't be here. This is a statue of Mahatma Gandhi that is located a few yards from my university, and it commemorates his visit to London in 1931, where the BBC collared him and asked him, "What do you think of Western civilization?" And Gandhi said, "I think it would be a good idea." And I want to start by saying, what do you think of technology in education? Because I think it would be a good idea. And like Gandhi, I don't think we've really seen it yet. We have seen technology transform just about every area of working and social life. Almost at random, I found an image of the roof, the newly restored roof of the British Museum, which overcame an amazing set of engineering obstacles and was virtually unbuildable without the application of new technology. There are, in fact, 1,386 triangular tiles in that roof, no two of which are the same, and new computational techniques had to be devised before it could be built. That's the kind of effect that technology is having in the outside world, and I don't need to tell you the kind of effect it's having on us, the way we do things, the way we search for information, the way we communicate with our friends. Just about every walk of our lives has been transformed by the application of technology, except one. Actually, maybe it's two. As I'm in a law school, I'm not completely sure it's really transformed law, but we'll have to ask the lawyers about that. The one that I want to focus on tonight is obviously education. This is a classroom from sometime in the 19th century. And this is kind of the best we can do as an antidote to the 19th century, but I think it's true that apart from the strangeness of the rectangular boxes and nothing much on the screens, which I think is a story in its own right, I think a teacher from that 19th century classroom would be pretty much at home with what was going on here. There's an interactive whiteboard instead of a slate board, but the chairs are all more or less facing the same way, and I think the teacher would not be very confused about what was going on. There are some quite spectacular changes that are going on in some classrooms in some parts of the world. This is a picture of some children working on the Personal Inquiry Project, which is one of the projects that I'm involved in through the Technology and Enhanced Learning Program. And the kids in the school, instead of leaving their mobile phones at the door of the school because they're troublesome for the teacher, they are encouraged to bring their phones into that school. These phones, by the way, are really powerful computers, and it just doesn't make sense to stack them up outside the door and then worry that we haven't got enough money to buy technology for schools. We don't even need much money. The kids have got the computers in their pocket. And this project is looking to see how science can become an outdoor and indoor activity, gathering data with the sensors on phones and other mobile devices. So there is some change in how we teach, and some of it is really powerful. This is another project in the set of projects for the TEL program. This one is teaching dentists how to drill teeth by a kind of virtual reality using haptic technology. Haptic technology means that the technology is sensitive to touch. And so they started out trying to mirror precisely what would happen with a real set of teeth, and then realized that that was a futile thing to try and do, a relatively straightforward thing to do. But what was really interesting is that you could do things that you couldn't do with an ordinary drill, like magnify the tooth or replay the drilling and so on. This has turned into a fantastically successful project. But it focuses, like nearly every implementation of technology that one comes across, it focuses on how to teach and how to learn and how to organize classrooms differently. It doesn't focus on the question of knowledge. And it's the issue of knowledge that I want to focus on this evening exclusively. I'm going to try to outline for you the idea that there is new knowledge to be learned that was unlearnable before we had the technology. New knowledge that we have to help people to learn, because otherwise they can't be decent citizens and decent workers in the 21st century. But knowledge which would have been unthinkable, let alone unteachable and unlearnable, without the application of digital technologies. And I'm going to start with an example of the kind of knowledge I'm talking about. If you were from Europe, the date in 2007, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, would be etched in your memory. But I'm sure you know all about it. And just shortly after it happened, this catastrophic event in the financial stratosphere, the chief financial officer of Goldman Sachs was interviewed for American TV, and he said, "We were seeing things that were 25 standard deviation moves several days in a row," said Goldman Sachs' financial advisor, 2007. Now, I'm going to explain what that means. What he means is, things always happen roughly according to the normal distribution. Shoe size is like that. All kinds of things are like that. The whole world looks as if it's like that if you don't look too closely. And here's the curve. You can see 3 standard deviations, not much room there, but 25 standard deviations is a long way. To give you some idea of just how far it is, the expected waiting time for this to happen would be 6 × 10 with 124 zeros on the end of it times the life of the universe. That's how long it would take, reasonably, to find an event happening 25 standard deviations from the mean. And this guy was seeing this happen 3 days in a row. It's hard to imagine anybody being so wrong. In a book I just recently read, this amazing pronouncement turns out to be equivalent to winning the UK National Lottery 18 days in a row. And you know, it might be, I've never spoken to this man, it might be that he knows very well that this little piece of embedded mathematics is wrong. He might know. After all, he is the chief financial advisor of Goldman Sachs, or he was. But that makes it even worse, because he thinks that by talking that language of the normal distribution, which everybody learns when they're at school, he will be able to communicate, have a shared understanding, and there is a general agreement that things are okay because we're modeling the situation in the traditional way. And I think the point I'd like to make is that this kind of knowledge, applying out in this case an outdated and clearly just plain wrong mathematical model to an event, is a wonderful example of learning the learnable. Because it's easy. You can learn this kind of stuff without technology. You can learn it with a pencil and paper and, I suppose, a calculator, which is technology, but not transformative technology in the sense that I'm using the word. So here we are on the chasm, learning what is learnable, and nearly everything that we try to teach so painstakingly has been shaped, influenced by, not determined by, but shaped by the technology with which it was given birth. We think of the things that we learn. That's why, until very recently, history was just lists of facts. It's very hard to teach anything other than that unless you have movies and the internet and so on. Makes it much easier to do other things. But really, we're stuck. This is my first thesis of the evening, really. We're stuck in a situation where formal learning is about teaching the teachable and learning the learnable. And across the chasm on the other side is knowledge that is only just becoming learnable and which is very difficult to jump over to. I don't want to be mistaken for thinking that somehow just by buying enough technology or having powerful enough mobile phones, everything's going to be all right, because that isn't my thesis at all. Now, often, no prize for knowing who the one with white hair is, but the other one, anybody know? Who is it?
Oppenheimer.
It's Robert Oppenheimer. And I just love this photograph because it's quite obvious that they are sharing a meaning together. And my money is going to be that it's that what Einstein is writing down is an equation. It might be a picture. But if you speak the language of mathematics and the language of computer modeling, if you speak the language of equations, there is a world that opens up to you that you can be relaxed about, that you can communicate with your peers with. But we know that that language is very complex. And we know that most people never manage to achieve fluency in that language. And the reason? Well, some ideas are just plain unlearnable because of the way they are represented. But if we represented those ideas in different ways, some of those ideas would become learnable and teachable in ways that they manifestly are not. And that's the second thesis of the evening. So I want to give you an example of what I mean. This is a swarm of birds. You've all seen this happen. You've all been completely stunned by the beauty of it. And you've all wondered to yourself, admit it, I wonder how they know which way to go. And you've asked yourself, is there a bird in the front? How does that bird, is that bird different from all the other birds, like a kind of born as a leader bird or something? I mean, that's a reasonable assumption, because they do know where they're going and they do fly in formation. If you look very carefully, the birds actually rotate at the same time as flying forward, and there is doesn't seem to be a bird in the lead. Well, you'll be glad to know the next slide gives you a perfect explanation of this phenomenon, which I'm sure you'll be delighted to see. This is genuinely a paper called On the Flocking of Birds, and I have spoken to somebody whose best friend was the mathematician that wrote the paper, so this is really 3 degrees of separation. But joking apart, this is the language that until now you have to speak if you want to understand beautiful phenomena. And it's true for the flocking of birds, just like it's true for understanding the collapse of the financial system. But we have tools now that will let us investigate these kinds of phenomena. Let me show you one. On the right-hand side of the screen, in the big black square, I'm going to place a few hundred birds. And then, using the buttons on the left, which I really don't need to explain, I'm not going to explain, and I realize they're not self-evident, I'm going to see what happens if I manage to tell each bird exactly the same thing. And that thing is, keep your eye on the nearest bird and adjust your speed and heading accordingly. I'm going to tell every bird that. So here's how it works. I'm going to put up 300 and something birds. Here they go. And I'm going to set them moving. And every bird is going to do the same thing. You'll see they're in random headings. And now suddenly they start to cluster, and they start to all go the same way. And if I fiddled with the parameters a little bit more, I could make it look more realistic. Like all models, the more data you feed in and the more rules you feed in underpinning the data, the better you can get. But the point I want to make is this. This is a very simple thing to do. And if you would be daunted to try to write the program, which is really just three lines of program, you don't have to, because this is a visible model. This is a model whose control panels are down the left-hand side of the screen. And even though I haven't told you what they do, you have to take my word for just one thing that I've said already, which is every single bird has the same rule, which is look out for the bird nearest you and adjust yourself according to him, or maybe her. I don't know if birds are single gender and then they flock. This is in contrast to the way things work in our world. The way things work in our world is that they have masses of computational, mathematical, and scientific power built into them. This is the classic example, which is completely invisible. When I was a little boy, I used to take my father's watch to pieces and try to put it back together again, which I wasn't completely successful at. I still have the watch, and every year it has to be rebuilt. If I took this watch to pieces, I'd see a chip. And there is virtually nobody in the world who can read that chip unless they have the proprietary piece of software that will allow them to do it. And I think it's a metaphor for our times, that the more we are at the mercy of technologies and of mathematics and of science, the less visible that technology and that mathematics and that science actually is. And this causes a great potential difficulty for us as citizens of the 21st century, which I'll map out. Just the day before I came to Australia, I was trying to sort out my pension. I didn't have any premonition about anything that would happen in Australia. And I was speaking to this guy on the phone who told me the calculation that I had to do, and it all was terribly simple, I thought. And he said, now you multiply by the number of years you've worked, and then you do this, and then you take away that, and now you multiply by 19. And I said, why do you multiply by 19? He said, because it says so on page 23 of the manual. We did some research recently with people who spend their working lives in call centres answering questions about mortgages. Their whole lives are about mortgages, their whole working lives. And we were working with them to try and get them to understand a little bit more about the models underpinning what they were seeing on the spreadsheets in front of them. And we thought, we'll do an easy thing first and get them going, and then we'll show them the complexity in a very unthreatening way. So we said, supposing that some investment was 0.5% per month, how much percent would it be per year? And we thought, well, they'd say multiply by 12, they'd say 6% a year, and we'd say, very good first attempt, but you've forgotten about compounding and so on. Of the 8 people that we were working with, 5 of them had never asked themselves whether there was any connection between the monthly and annual percentage rate. What they believed was that the management set these numbers arbitrarily simply to get as much money as they could, and that there was no reason why it should be 12, 13, or 25 times more. They even admitted, one of them admitted, that he had a huge loan on his credit card because he thought that the interest rate had been annual, and now he understood that it must be monthly. That's a very sad story. And before I go on, let me just indulge in some completely shameless advertising. I and Celia Hoyles, my work and life colleague, have just written a book with 2 other colleagues, which is called Improving Mathematics at Work, The Need for Techno-Mathematical Literacies. No explanation forthcoming on the title at this point, which you may be interested in, but if not, put it down to shameless advertising. But here's the point. Just like these guys in the mortgage company who really believed that the numbers were just numbers arbitrarily out of nowhere, we began to see during that research, which was many years' work, began to see that there's something more to this. That we discovered huge numbers of people just not realizing that numbers have a life of their own. It's a bit like a number 9 bus. I thought I'd have a little bit of memory of home here. Nobody in their right mind would think that the number 18 bus was twice the length of the number 9 bus. Actually, this one is. But seriously, you know, numbers are more than just labels. And I want to just share with you something that shows where we get to if we're content for this state of affairs to endure. We have a journalist in the UK called Peter Hitchens, who's famous for his extremist views, far-right extremist views. And one of the things he is famous for is that he's a climate change denier. He thinks that the climate change is a communist plot, and that there is no such thing as climate change. And here's what he says. He says, all scientific data are suppositions, allegations, predictions. Numbers prove nothing. Now, given that using numbers and the language of numbers, you can predict everything from the falling of a leaf to the formation of distant black holes, this is a pretty strong assertion. And one could have a philosophical debate about what he means by prove. Numbers don't prove things. But numbers are everywhere in our society. And if one really is content to believe that using numbers, and by implication computational models and computers and so on, nothing comes of that, that it's all just as arbitrary as the mortgage repayments in the call centre we worked in, then that's a pretty bad state of affairs. And again, a little bit like the Goldman Sachs example, even if Hitchens knows very well that this is an over-exaggeration, the fact that he writes in a newspaper that circulates 5.5 million copies a day and outsells nearly all the other newspapers in the country is very worrying, because there is a voice for this. It goes along with, oh, I was never any good at numbers, I never could understand mathematics, computers are a mystery to me, and so on. So I want to make it clear that I'm not blaming either ourselves as citizens or those of you who are teachers here. This is a huge job, but we have to do it, and it's a job that concerns knowledge. It isn't going to be solved by simply doing what we always did in a new way. This is a photograph of a roll of, I don't know what you call it here, we call it cling film. It's the stuff you wrap food in that you see through, very, very thin stuff. Is it called cling film here? Okay. But anyway, you've got the idea. And this company that we worked in and worked with the people there makes this stuff by the hundreds of miles. Quite interesting when you see industrial processes like this. This is a picture of what they call the bubble, where the film finally gets its final stretching after a huge number of iterations and heating and cooling and all sorts of things that needn't concern us. And the interesting thing was that the workers on the shop floor had control panels. This is an example of a control panel that they used, and you'll see, without knowing anything about the process, but you can see roughly that it's a kind of representation of the way that the bubble gets built, and that's all, obviously, at this point that I want to say about that. We discovered some interesting things, not least of which is that there were two shifts, a day shift and a night shift, one run by Bill and the other run by Jim. And Bill and Jim had friendly competitions to see how many miles of this stuff they could work. And they actually engaged in slight sabotage of each other's shifts. So that just as Jim was about to knock off and Bill came on, they'd turn up some buttons and flick some switches. One of the companies we worked in was so worried about this tendency of minor sabotage that they installed a flashy new computer panel with buttons and switches and neon lights and all kinds of things, which wasn't connected to anything. And apparently, you know, Fred would still come in and say, ah, there you are, we've made an extra 13 miles today, that's because I put that switch to zero. We didn't verify that story, but that was told to us by one of the foremen on the shop floor. We thought it would be a good idea to turn this read-only device into a read-write device. So to take, as faithfully as we could, the control panel that they had and turn it into a control panel that you really could fiddle with without destroying the process. And here it is running. I haven't got the sound on, but that little explosion gives a nice, satisfying bang. And we had queues of people queuing up to try and use it and see how quickly they could make the bubble bang. But the point is, we turned a read-only device into a read-write device. And there is a little grain of the message I want to leave you with when I finish, which is, we have the challenge. One of the ways of jumping over that chasm is to try to turn what are hitherto read-only devices, devices whose inner workings are unfathomable, unlearnable, and unteachable without technologies, turn them into read-write devices where people can actually see some version of how they work. And I'm just going to play you a few seconds of an interesting comment, because I don't want to leave you with the impression that I think that teaching and learning has to be focused on what people need in workplaces. It's much more important than that. I want to leave you with a comment from the chief executive officer of the company that made the Kling film. It's only a 30-second clip. Well,
I think the projects are absolutely excellent. The work that's gone into this has been outstanding. And I think there's one part of this that goes a bit beyond the mathematical side, which has been the focus. That's been sort of the soft side of what the end user gains, the empowerment that the end user has, the knowledge that the person has when all is said and done, the job satisfaction that the operators now have that's still there. So I think that's really one of the great parts of this entire project and all the work that's gone into this.
So this is a surprising thing for somebody like him to say, I think. The thing that he really cared about as much as, and we cared about it too, but as much as helping people learn the unlearnable, is also to feel empowered, that they understood the machines that they were using every day of their lives, that they felt, we found people having conversations about the process in their lunch hour. And as you can see from the points made by the chief executive officer, that's a really important thing, both at work and more broadly in terms of being a citizen. I think I want to just say a few words about the idea of techno-mathematical literacies, which is an ugly phrase, but we haven't come up with anything better yet. The point being that there are new literacies now that everybody needs that go beyond simple reading, writing, and arithmetic. That even though it's true that for many people in the world, let's just for the moment consider the developed world. For many people in the world, there is a huge amount of stuff that they don't need to know anymore at all. The checkout operator in the supermarket, for example. But for many people, even if there are things that they no longer need to know, there are new things that people need to know. And I pointed at some of those. There are computational literacies, ways of thinking about what computers do and how computers work, of splitting problems into smaller parts, of tracing how they work, of finding mistakes, and of critiquing other people's models so that the person in the street would be able to say something like, it can't be 25 standard deviations from the norm, that's longer than the life of the universe. A recent report in the UK published by the Royal Society says, children must understand and play an active role in the digital world that surrounds them, not to be passive consumers of opaque and mysterious technology. We are all passive consumers of mysterious technology. But I want to know what happens when I click on Google. I want to know how it is that Google Translate suddenly gives translations that are readable, whereas up till last year it didn't. And the other day, somebody who's an expert in the field explained it to me, and it's really simple. They just set Google to read billions and billions of words, given up trying to find models that specify a language, and just throw in billions and billions of sentences and paragraphs of other people's data so that the machines recognize it when they see it. I want people to know that. I want people to understand what it means to say that your mobile phone is connected 24/7. It means that everybody can see where you are, what you're doing, what speed you're traveling at, and so on. These are not deep, impossible things, but of course, if you start to dig a little bit deeper, you do need to design special things to help people understand them, and that's where I want to go now. Because making things learnable is just too important to pick up the crumbs of other people's technologies. We have to design. If you want to build this Olympic stadium in London, you have to use special tools that are designed for architects. And if you want to understand how things work, we have to find ways, and we have to find money, and we have to find make it a priority to build things that are designed for learning and designed for education. Because everywhere you go now, there are these wonderful technologies. I mean, how many people here have got iPads? Please put your hand up. It's just amazing. Because a year ago, none of you had heard of one, or a year and a half ago, nobody knew what an iPad was. And this thing, it's just an amazing piece of technology. When the iPad came out, I gave it a week, and then I thought it would be fun to see if there was a first app about learning mathematics on the iPad. So you might think, wow, obviously it has to exploit this fantastic multi-touch capability of the iPad, the fact that it's wafer thin so that people can share, the fact that it rotates as you pass it around. That's a really interesting thing to exploit and could potentially change the way people collaborate and converse with each other and so on. This is what I found. This is how to do adding up. Is it adding up or multiplication? No, it is actually adding up. And by the way, it doesn't teach you how to add up, which is an honorable thing. It just tests that whoever taught you to add up has done a decent job. So I think that we're in this strange situation where the limitation now isn't the technology, and very soon won't be the technology. In the developed world, at least, people are coming to school knowing a lot about technology and having that technology in their pocket. The problem is, what are the unlearnable ideas that people need, and how are we going to design technology to make them learnable? I'm going to give you a couple of examples just to make the point. Here's a really unlearnable idea. There are some numbers in the world who just go on forever. This is a really deep mathematical idea, and we expect children to engage with it, I don't know, in the UK about the idea, about the age of 14 or 15. It's a very difficult idea. We find that, for example, people say, they look at a number like that, they have no idea what the three dots means. Why should they? I mean, why three dots? Does it matter that there's three dots and not two or four? And they see this funny little dot between the three and the one, and the best thing to do then is just ignore that. So it's a very, I won't say unlearnable idea. I'm sure a lot of people here learned what they needed to learn about it. But there's deep ideas hidden in this thing. Like, it goes on forever, so it's very hard to hold in your hand. That the value of the digits gets smaller and smaller as you go further and further to the right. And we thought, supposing we built a system where kids could do anything they wanted to do, to write a computer program that would do anything they wanted to do, but to do it in such a way that it was all done by cartoon characters. And I must thank Ken Kahn for inventing this system. It's called Toon Talk. And it is a tour de force. And here's what happens. Let me just show you. Again, I'm going to suppress all detail, and I'm not going to explain what this funny little thing here and so on, but this is my hand. Well, kind of. I'm going to divide one by a very big number for kids of 499, fantastically big number. And you see, now we have shrinking digits, but you say they shrink so much you can't see them, so let's pump them up and make them bigger. And you can hold this number in your hand, and now you're thinking to yourself, yes, but there must be an approximation. And the answer is no. That number is infinitely precise, provided that you're prepared to wait quite a long time to get where you want to get. But it is infinitely precise, and for those of you with a technical bent, if I took that number there and multiplied it by 499, I would get 1, not 0.99999. So this is a very trivial little example, although it took us 3 years to come up with this. This is just a simple little example, which is part of a much bigger system, but it makes the point. If you want to learn unlearnable ideas, find new ways to represent those ideas, and preferably ideas that mesh with your intuitions, that are fun. Did you see the little mouse that came and banged the numbers together? We didn't find a single kid or teacher who secretly, we would go in between lessons and find that they were making the mouse run in and bang numbers together for no particular reason, because it was just such fun to do that. I'm going to just tell you a couple of things about a very recent project that we've completed in the London Knowledge Lab. And this project, which is called the MyGen Project, is based on the following observation: that algebra is not a good way to learn algebra. Algebra is two things. It's this absolutely magnificent tool for expressing general ideas. Every even number is the sum of two prime numbers. This conjecture has been unsolved for hundreds of years, and it's unthinkable to even try to solve a problem like that without algebra, because it doesn't matter how many examples you find, the next one might violate the rule. So algebra is this fantastic system that Einstein and Oppenheimer were probably using when they were having their interesting conversation. But we turn it into an obscure set of lessons about X's and Y's and Z's. And I've lost track of the number of people who say to me, oh, you're a mathematician, that's interesting. I loved maths when I was at primary school, but I got stuck when I went to secondary school and had to do algebra. Is there anybody in this room that comes into that category? I'm sure not. And I think this is a great example. We have the real thing that we want to teach for the 21st century, that you can express the general even if you don't know its value. But we get bogged down, even though we have machines in our pockets that will do this mysterious transposition of X's and Y's and carrying across the equal signs and so on. So in the project that we worked in, and again, I'm going to run very fast over it without giving any details, we had a system where kids could actually build things using a quasi-algebraic language, a language that was much simpler than algebra. It's very hard to build a system like this, and we tried to build into it artificial intelligence in two directions. First of all, to support exploration. That's very difficult. Artificial intelligence is easiest when it's simple, intelligent tutoring. In order to achieve this, first you do that, and then you do that, and the computer is keeping its eye on you and will tell you when you've gone wrong, and if you're lucky, nudge you into the next level. But if you want kids to express their ideas, and you can't predict precisely what they're going to say or how they're going to do it, then artificial intelligence is a very difficult tool. We predicated what we did, by the way, that we were not trying to replace the teachers, but to give teachers support. And I think we're going to see more of this as time goes on. I think there was, in the world of technology-enhanced learning research, a general idea that maybe teachers could be somehow replaced by technology. That will not happen in our lifetime. It will happen one day, and it might be a sad day, but it won't happen yet, because we don't know how people learn. We don't know enough about how people learn or what a good teacher is to build the machines. In my view, that's a happy state of affairs. So our system tried to track students, and it tried to give teachers advice like, let's group these children together, because it turns out that John and Patrick have very dissimilar ways of solving this problem, and it would be really useful if they got together and helped each other and sorted it out between them. So that's a project that we've just finished. And I want to, I'm really very near the end of my talk now, I just want to make one last point on the theme of knowledge. We have to build learning technologies. There is a massive effort going on worldwide in hundreds of locations to try and build technologies to learn unlearnable things and to teach unteachable things. But there are hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people who need to learn those things, and we are nowhere near scaling out so that these latest techniques and these latest pieces of research can be used by ordinary people in ordinary classrooms or on the job and so on. But there is one aspect that I think makes the point forcibly enough that I'm going to end with it. And that is, the knowledge that we teach, I've been talking about new knowledge as if it's going to drop down from the sky, it's completely impossible to imagine. But really, it's a shorthand for thinking about how little pieces of knowledge that we want people to learn are connected to each other. And one of the things that learning research has spent a huge amount of time trying to do, for various reasons, is to come up with a kind of best sequence of learning. You often hear people talking about what are the prerequisites for this piece of learning. So one of the things in the field of science is that it's absolutely common sense and agreed by everybody that one should start with understanding how objects stand still if you put them on the table. What's happening if I put this phone on the table? Well, the table is pushing back at the phone. The phone is being attracted to the table by gravity. They cancel each other out so it doesn't move. That's great. Next step in complexity, that's a prerequisite for understanding the next thing, which is the phone moving at constant speed. I haven't got an ice rink here, but I could do a pretty fair impression of it moving at constant speed if I did. And then finally, the interesting case, which is that the speed is changing all the time and we have acceleration. Now, why do we decide that it should be done in that order? We do it in that order because if the technology that is at your disposal is the technology of pencil and paper, it's probably the best thing to do. But it's terribly difficult because this special case of nothing happening is really so boring that you can't blame kids for going to sleep when they learn about normal forces and so on. Because the phone is on the table is pushing the phone, you can't see anything, you can't feel anything. It doesn't make sense. And yet anybody who's been in a car, it doesn't have to be a BMW, anybody who's been in a car going round a corner has experienced this strange feeling of acceleration where you feel you're being thrown out of the car. Why? Why is that such a difficult idea? We could make that idea learnable because it's an idea that everybody has experienced and on whose insights we can build. But in order to do that, we need dynamic technologies. We need to be able to reproduce things that move, and we need to be able to uncover from those things what makes them tick, what makes them work. So I'll leave you with the following thought. Yes, we can begin to learn the unlearnable and teach the unteachable. But if we want to do that, we have to radically rethink what we teach as well as how we teach it. Thank you very much. Do I sit down? Or
no, you stand.
Is this going to be bad?
This is going to be bad.
Okay.
My job is to thank Richard here this evening for his talk to us, and I think you can see why he has been asked back, and I hope there are many more occasions when that's happened. When I looked at the title, Teaching the Unteachable, it was a bit threatening sitting in the audience knowing that we were the unteachable, but I've learned that that's not quite true. Certainly the notion of the nature of new knowledge and what that new knowledge can be that we can learn because of technology was exciting, and certainly the work that I'm doing and Patrick and others are doing about how we can take a lot of that knowledge and do the kind of things you were saying about switching it from something that people read to look at how we can concentrate on the reporting of it in more interesting ways. I think that's really fascinating. And so how we can learn that unlearnable. Part of the theme I thought you were saying is that we may get to the stage where we don't need to know, we just need to understand. I think that's a really good notion about what we may have to do in our classrooms. You did comment that teachers don't need to be threatened, they may not be necessarily replaced, but I remember B.F. Skinner saying at one point that if a computer can do better than a teacher, for goodness sake, get rid of that teacher. There's a bit of that still out there in that. But at the end, you ended up with a problem that I think is just huge in this area. How do we scale out? And how do we take the notions that you've invited us to think? And I think the other exciting part, Richard, is that you haven't talked about the gadgets. You've talked about what they can do, and you've talked about how it can be done right across the curriculum. I think that's exciting. But in the end, as part of thanking you, I do want to go back to the 25 standard deviations, because I think that the University of Melbourne Reds are 25 standard deviations better than the British Reds, and I hope you and Celia thoroughly enjoy it. Would you join me in thanking Richard?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Wow. I don't have any questions if you want to.
Look, there's nearly time for a question, but I will allow two, because I think the reason we don't normally have questions, I know there's one up the back, one of my team came and spoke to me halfway through that and said, caterers haven't turned up. I've never been let down like this before, and it's not my team's fault. So I think, given that, we'll allow two questions, then those who want to have an interchange with Richard can do so for a few minutes afterwards. Yes, there's one at the back.
Thank you very much for such a thought-provoking presentation. My quick question is, are you saying in one way that we've been given a brand new toy and we're still getting to know what it is and we have no idea what we can really do with it?
Yeah. when cars were started to be mass manufactured, they had indicator flaps that did that, because that's what you do with your arm. In fact, I have to confess that my father had one of these when I was a little boy. And what else do you do with a new technology? You recapitulate what you did with the old technology, but then sooner or later, somebody comes up with a better, more efficient, cheaper way. But people had to learn to read the flashing lights. I mean, the first time somebody saw one of those was probably they had no idea what it meant. So yeah, I think you're right.
Nicola. Hang on, just so everyone hears the question, just wait for the microphone to sprint down the aisle.
Hi, Richard, and once again, thanks for an amazing talk. I'm just wondering, a bit of a thought-provoking question is, what's the point of building learning technologies for a curriculum that actually reflects old knowledge and old learning?
Well, if that state of affairs continues, then there isn't one. That's the truth of it. But look, let me say something optimistic about this. We have a Secretary of State for Education in the UK who's been in power for over a year now, and who suddenly, in the middle of last year, seems to have seen the light. He would have been at home with half of my talk. He makes visionary speeches about the role that technology can play, and he's talking about learning things. He's accepted the Royal Society report by his utterances. He seems to have accepted it. So there might be, in some slots in the world, a kind of zeitgeist for change. But you're right, of course, if the curriculum stays unchanged and the assessment procedures stay unchanged, that's really an important point, then there isn't going to be any point except employing people like me to be researchers.
All right, I'm going to conclude the evening there, and I do apologise for those of you that were really developing that thirst.
This isn't going to go far enough.
No, we'll leave that with you. So I just want to endorse John's comments. It was a really challenging and engaging lecture, and could you join me again in thanking Richard for it?
Thank you. Thanks so much, Phil.